Welcome to Let's Talk About Obesity Care, a podcast series from Let's Go. The series is focused on thought-provoking and informative conversations to support medical providers interested in obesity prevention and treatment. I'm your host, Carrie Gordon, a pediatric nephrologist turned childhood obesity treatment physician. I am a clinical advisor to Let's Go, a childhood obesity prevention program of the Barbara Bush Children's Hospital, and a practicing specialist at Maine Medical Center's Weight and Wellness Program in lovely Portland, Maine. Today, we're talking with Dr. Peter Ammon, a colleague of mine at Maine Medical Center's Weight and Wellness Program. Pete is an ABOM certified family medicine provider who has shifted his work to encompass only obesity care at this point. Welcome, Pete.
Thanks, Carrie. Happy to be here.
Hey, Pete, let's start off just by talking a little bit about how and why you left primary care to shift to only obesity work.
So I was practicing regular kind of full spectrum family medicine for a total of 17 years since I graduated from residency. Lots of our patients obviously struggled with their weight, struggled with the medical conditions and diagnoses that go along with carrying extra weight. And I felt like in primary care, it was very difficult to address this problem, this medical diagnosis, completely because of there were so many other things that are necessary to address in a short visit with primary care. So understanding how important this was to our patients, I was able to help kind of craft this medical program for the adult patients with obesity, just like you have been working with the pediatric patients for years. And we worked with Let's Go and worked with the Weight and Wellness Program that has been existing probably for 15 or 20 years with surgery, to add a medical component for the patients that have obesity that may or may not want to pursue surgery. And we can give them extra help if they're dedicated to focusing on this part of their life and part of their health, more so than we could do in a primary care setting.
Well, I'm wondering also, you didn't bring this up, but I'm wondering also if maybe some of the shift was motivated by the fact that we have some new tools that make treating obesity sort of more effective and therefore obviously sort of more satisfying. Can you talk a bit about how the care of patients with obesity has changed for you over the years and maybe some of what you've noticed about the changes in success rate with some of the new tools we have?
Sure. I think one of the biggest paradigm shifts, I would say, with regard to treatment of obesity is the designation of obesity back in 2013 as a disease. So we used to think of obesity as just lack of willpower, not enough exercise, eating the wrong foods. And we now know it's very complicated. It's very hormonally mediated. The drive to eat is very strong. And people get in this rut where they get in this vicious circle of gaining weight. There's increased inflammation in their system, increased hunger, and it goes on over years or decades. So the neat thing is, as a medical problem, we now have tools, which include medicines. We've had surgery, but I think we do a better job kind of figuring out who might benefit from surgery and a better job preparing patients to be successful with weight loss surgery. So over time, people can be a healthier weight. So we don't always end up with a normal weight, but if someone's body mass index goes from a BMI of 50 or 60, which is very high, to BMI in the 30s, it might still be high, but they are healthier. Their comorbid diabetes or comorbid sleep apnea or high blood pressure often can be improved to the point that sometimes they can stop medicines or stop treatment. And really kind of we can improve people's quality of life so they can enjoy life better and longer. Some of the tools we use are medicines. So there are a handful of weight loss medicines that are FDA approved for treatment. Medicines can obviously come at a cost. They can come with side effects, but some of them can be very effective for patients. And we walk people through the options for medications and then obviously talk to them as well if they're interested in hearing about surgery as a treatment option, which can be very effective for them.
Many of the prescription medication interventions that we use to treat obesity, not all, but many, have some crossover with treating mental health disorders or addiction. Can you tell the listeners a bit about how your care overlaps in the areas of mental health, another obviously really pressing issue in this time? And can you give some examples of
like therapeutic combinations that you've used that improve not only a patient's BMI, but also some of the comorbid mental issues?
Sure. So I'll first address the fact that some of the medicines we use in psychiatry, some of the medicines we use in primary care definitely can increase weight, right? So medicines can increase appetite. Typically, the medicines that make us tired that we might take at bedtime might increase appetite, might increase weight. So part of our job as a medical bariatrician is to look at someone's medication list that they come in with and see if there are alternatives that are more weight neutral or weight negative for patients, but might still provide the same efficacy or benefits with regard to their mental health issues. Certainly, we've had a medicine for the whole time I've been a doctor, so 20 plus years. One of the medicines we use regularly in primary care is bupropion, which is brand name is Wellbutrin. It's also used as a medicine called Zyban to help people quit smoking. That medicine, compared to other medicines we might use for depression, tends to decrease appetite and help with weight loss. There's a brand name medicine, FDA approved for weight loss, called Contrave, which we've used probably for 5 or 6 years now, which is a combination of the Wellbutrin, which we've had for 20 years, and a medicine called Naltrexone, which is actually the same exact ingredient that we use in a medicine called Narcan, which we use to prevent deaths from overdose with opiates. So the thought is this medicine Narcan, or the generic medicine Naltrexone, kind of blocks that receptor in our brain that causes an overdose with narcotics, but also probably blocks the cravings. So we use Naltrexone for people who struggle with alcohol use disorder. It might help with decreased cravings for alcohol. And similarly, when we use the Naltrexone combined with bupropion to make the brand name of Contrave, or we use the generic components of it, it can help decrease appetite and decrease cravings, which is very interesting. We also use a medicine which is brand name called Qsymia, so Qsymia, which is FDA approved for weight loss. Also, probably 5 or 6 years we've been using this medicine. It's a combination of two medicines. One is a stimulant called phentermine, which we've had probably 40 years. And the second is a medicine called topiramate, which we've used for years for seizures. We also use it for migraine headaches. And the combination of these two medicines also kind of decreases cravings, decreases appetite, and helps facilitate weight loss for our patients.
And can you talk a bit about how much weight loss you see using these medications? I mean, I can tell you that you have a lot more experience than I've had with using the medications, and this is off label, some of the use of this medicine for children. But, you know, it seems sometimes like one medicine does nothing for somebody, but another medicine might make a huge difference. And, you know, are there ways we can be steered in the right direction? Or have you seen that same variability where it's kind of like finding that right medicine?
Right. So sometimes it definitely is a trial and error proposition where we try one of the medicines. If we do the combination medicine like Qsymia or Contrave, we'll often start with the generic one of the medicines, low dose, see how they do for a week or a few weeks or a month, and then add the low dose of the second medicine to create the kind of the generic equivalent, and kind of increase dose as tolerated. So the goal always is to use the lowest dose possible for the shortest amount of time. And it definitely varies with regard to how successful these medications are. So sometimes we can use side effects of medications in our favor. So if someone is struggling with mood issues, we can add bupropion. And if someone has headaches, we can consider using topiramate, which is FDA approved for headaches. And it's definitely a bell-shaped curve with regard to people who have success with the medicine. Some people have side effects. They stop it after a few days or a few weeks because of side effects. Some people can have side effects to begin with and then tolerate it once they're getting used to it over the next couple of weeks. And it varies. So some people can lose 5% or 10%, which is kind of the average for the weight loss pills that we prescribe. And some people are super responders and they can lose 15% or more of their baseline weight. Now, not always are people happy with 10% or 15%, but we know that even small amounts of weight loss, 3%, 5%, 10%, can be helpful with regard to improving energy, improving sleep, improving their blood sugar, improving their blood pressure. So part of it is to work with the patients on setting reasonable goals, short-term goals with regard to what we can expect, you know, from lifestyle changes, you know, trying to be more active, trying to make some changes with regard to diet, maybe improving sleep, you know, seeing a counselor if you need to with regard to mood issues or anxiety issues, you know, and what kind of results we could expect or hope from the medications. Sometimes one of the medicines won't work, so we'll try a different one. So it's definitely variable. And one of the things that we as doctors and providers here and the patients need to have is a little bit of patience, because something might work for someone and it might not work for the second person we try it with.
And how about some tools that work a little bit more towards the insulin resistance pathways? And we haven't talked about those medications at all. I know some of those are readily available and some are a little harder to get coverage for. Do you want to talk a bit about those?
Yeah, sure. So we know that lots of our patients have insulin resistance. So they might not have elevated blood sugars. They might not yet have prediabetes or diabetes, but over time we see people who carry extra weight definitely have a higher risk to develop blood sugar issues over time. But we see a lot of people who they might be making a lot of insulin in their own body to keep their blood sugars low. But the problem with making a lot of insulin is that insulin causes the blood sugars to decrease, but it stores that blood sugar as fat, and that can cause weight to increase. So we've known for years that treatment of diabetes with insulin or other medicines sometimes can increase weight. But there are a newer family of medicines that we can use that are more weight neutral or weight negative. One of these groups of medicines are called GLP-1 agonists, and these have been around probably for 5 or 6 years. And can be quite helpful to treat type 2 diabetes, but also have been shown to have some pretty good effect with regard to weight loss for some patients. Now, these medicines are mostly injections. They're either once a day or once a week injections. There is a version of one of the medicines, which is a pill, but we don't quite know if this is very effective for weight loss at this point. But the once a week injections have been shown to be fairly effective, and as effective or more effective than some of the pills. The problem though, for some people is one, it's an injection. So not everybody is comfortable or willing to do an injection. And then two, it's an expensive medicine. So this can be several hundred dollars or more per month. And we're trying to work with insurances to get this treatment covered. However, in the absence of prediabetes or insulin resistance or type 2 diabetes, sometimes it's an uphill battle to get this medicine covered for patients who are struggling with obesity, but don't have diabetes on their problem list as well.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, it can be a real barrier to treat patients when you have challenges with insurance coverage. It can be pretty frustrating.
For sure. I mean, so, you know, we work with the patients, work with insurance. Sometimes we'll write letters asking for this medicine to be covered for the patient. Especially if they have tried other medicines that may have not worked for them as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know you've done a lot of work with Let's Go trying to help support and advocate for primary care providers to, you know, have more sort of understanding and access to some of the tools that you found so successful. You know, obviously, in probably most states, but in a state like Maine, when you look at the number of patients we have who could benefit from specialty obesity care versus sort of the access, we know not everybody's going to be able to get into the specialty practices. What do you see as the role for primary care providers in this work outside of referring patients with obesity to specialty care?
So having been a primary care doc and realizing how busy all of them are with regard to everything that they're doing. And obviously, certainly with COVID in the past year and a half, people have been running out straight. And trying to ask them to do one more thing with regard to treatment of this disease is sometimes a heavy lift. I think if primary care docs are given time to address this medical problem or make the time by asking the patients to come back. So if they see them for a physical and they see that their weight has been increasing over the past few years, to have them come back specifically to focus on their weight, to focus on lifestyle, and perhaps to talk about medications, they'll have more time to focus on this problem and to think about specific treatments for it. I think some of it is having primary care docs be more comfortable and be more familiar with the medications. So there have been some weight loss medications which have come and gone over the past 20 to 30 years, and they were taken off the market because of sometimes quite significant side effects. So I think some of the primary care doctors are hesitant and nervous about using medications for weight loss. The interesting thing is that a lot of the medicines we're using now are kind of repurposed medicines that we've been using for 30 years. So there is some familiarity with medicines like bupropion and topiramate that doctors have used for years. So part of our job, and you and I both work with the Let's Go program, is to kind of help them learn about and be more comfortable and provide a resource for them to be more comfortable prescribing these medications to the appropriate patients in the setting of lifestyle change. So I always tell patients the medicines don't work all by themselves. They don't magically kind of evaporate the extra calories people are eating, but they put people in a better place to be more successful. So if they have decreased cravings and they're not as hungry, they can make better choices, and it has people take a step back so they can make better choices to be healthier, to kind of help them, you know, eat less, drink fewer calories, and move in the right direction, so that over time they'll realize some improvement in their health when they lose 3% of their weight, 5% of their weight, 10%, et cetera.
What do you see as some of the practice barriers that we still have left to tackle? I mean, I feel like not everybody in primary care has access to some of the tools that we have at Weight and Wellness outside of even, confidence and competence with using medications, but, you know, some of the other things you're alluding to, like changing how we're eating and all that.
Well, I think it's nice here at the Weight and Wellness program that we have access to social work. We have access to dietitians. We have access to group visits, which obviously with COVID are all online, but used to be in person. So we have more of a comprehensive program and a team to address this. I think some of the primary care offices, probably most of them, are very overwhelmed with regard to COVID and everything else they're dealing with, but also lack access to social work, for example. Although some have social work in their office, they often will report lack of access or adequate coverage with regard to seeing a dietitian, which is so important for patients. I'm the first to acknowledge that in medical school, we did not have a great curriculum with regard to learning about nutrition, but having some information for primary care docs to give the people the basics or focus on one or two things can be quite helpful. So my hope is that over the next, 3, 5, 10 years, we'll be able to provide more resources for primary care, both through the Let's Go program and through, local resources for them to use, so that people can have more of comprehensive care with regard to treating this disease of obesity. So it won't just be the primary care doctor or the primary care provider that has to do everything, but they'll have staff in their office, perhaps, or staff in the community, or be able to refer to a local exercise program for their patients, so that it takes a village to help treat this disease, and people will be more supported, not only primary care docs, but the patients, to have more success with their process.
Yeah, I'm sort of noticing a lot of the same, and on the pediatric side we have in our system, we've had such challenges with vacancies and social work positions, for example, or counseling positions, and with like many other areas of medical specialty, there are some nuances that we even ask for in some of the specialists some of our partners that we're working with. For example, it's so great when you can work with a dietitian who enjoys working with people with obesity, who knows motivational interviewing, or if you have a social worker who's got confidence in using some of the modalities that have been really successful for things like binge eating or internalized weight bias, like using cognitive behavioral therapy. I totally agree with you. It's like providing that support for people in primary care so that, they can take their piece, but they also have the tools that we have to help support some of the other pieces that we're just not trained to do.
Right. I always go back to thinking about, we're looking to help people with behavior change, and behavior change is one of the hardest things that all of us deal with. We've been doing it the same way for 20 or 30 years. So trying to make small changes that can be consistent is so hard. But part of the trick is kind of setting small steps and small goals, right? So not not with a goal of I want to lose 50 pounds by Christmas, but you know, I want to increase my exercise by, you know, 10 minutes a day once I drop my kid off at the bus stop, or trying to make small changes. I'll cut back on the number of sodas I drink from 4 to 3 per day. You know, something when people are using things that they can measure and measurable small goals, small steps, people will gain confidence and say, I can do this. I can make small changes. And when people lose 5% of their weight, which could be 10 or 20 pounds, they actually feel better. Their clothes might fit better. They might have more energy. So kind of building on that small success people have over time is how patients kind of lose that 50 pounds in a year or 2 years with medical treatment and feel better and have a better quality of life.
I think one of the other struggles we have is that people will tend to have more success if they have more frequent touch points. And I think there's definitely evidence to support that, but touch points are so hard, right? When we have, you know, at Weight and Wellness, we have so many referrals and, you know, it's that balance between seeing as many people as you can or having as frequent contact as you'd like. And I'm sure that's also a challenge in primary care.
Absolutely. You know, the more frequently people are seen at any weight loss program across the country kind of predicts the success they'll have. You know, there are community programs like Weight Watchers, et cetera, that have frequent touch points. Obviously pre-COVID, people have to go in once a week to get weighed and to kind of give an update on how they're doing, you know, but the more frequently we see people, and seeing people could be obviously virtually, could be via text, could be via phone call, you know, it could be via, you know, their primary care doctor's office, could be their counselor, the more successful people have over time with regard to weight loss. The other thing that people can do, obviously, is check in with themselves, right? So one of the things that we know is can be helpful is measuring things, right? Measuring steps, measuring water intake, measuring their weight, but also kind of journaling or kind of doing some self-reflection that every day or, you know, several times a week, they kind of write down, and it doesn't have to take a long time, but just write down a journal, kind of what went well, how'd I do, what were my kind of triggers today, you know, what could I do better tomorrow? And over time, you know, people can check in with themselves, which is ultimately the best thing we can do for ourselves and have more success, being more mindful of what drives our behavior, what drives our appetite, what drives our overdrinking, overeating. How do we feel, right? So it's really hard to get moving. But if you went to the gym or took a walk with your dog, how did I feel afterwards? You know, did I feel worse? Probably not. You know, did I feel better? Did I feel like, you know, it was worth that 10 or 15 minutes or 20 minutes of getting outside or doing some exercise? For sure. So part of the touch points is however we can get people to kind of touch base with themselves or touch base with their family members to see how they're doing, or if they have a partner. You know, if they're doing exercise or walking with a friend or touching base with a friend or their counselor or their PCP or our offices, that's how we can improve success.
And I know there are a lot of primary care providers out there, at least in the pediatric side, that have talked to me, you know, at one meeting or another where I've been giving presentations about language and how to speak to people about carrying extra weight and how to engage them without saying things in a way that's going to put them off. It's going to really, you want them to come back for those follow-up visits. You want them to feel supported. Do you have any, you probably come across this question as well when you do your work in the primary care practices. What do you say if a primary care provider wants to, you know, bring this up with a patient or wants to make a referral to the program? Are there any, you know, little tools you suggest for, or a language that you suggest they use?
So language is so important. You know, I think the language patients use themselves, the language we use as providers. I saw a patient the other day who saw a new orthopedic doctor who said, well, you're fat, what are we going to do about it? And that was so off-putting and it was so terrible for her to experience that. She's not going to go back to see that doctor. She doesn't feel like, you know, he was listening to her, doesn't feel like he saw her as a person. She felt like everything that she presented with her knee problems was related to her weight. And it could have been, but it could also not have been. So I think we need to be careful about the language we use here. People don't like to the term morbid obesity, which is something we've used for years. People don't like the term fatness. People don't like certain terms. but being more objective and maybe using their body mass index, or that they're carrying extra weight relative to where they're healthy, and using more kind of objective terms, that their BMI might be 37, you know, and they have comorbid high blood pressure, cholesterol, kind of diabetes, et cetera, is definitely better for people, you know. And again, to frame this in the form of like, this is a medical problem. This is a disease process, just like diabetes, just like depression, just like heart disease, and treating obesity as a disease kind of helps people kind of accept it and be more willing to engage in treatment of this disease process to help be healthier.
Yeah. So much of this challenge in language stems from just the bias that's been out there for such a long time that people who carry extra weight face. And like you said, sometimes the things they've heard that have been the most, made them the most uncomfortable, that have been the most offensive, have been in places where you're pretty vulnerable. Like you hear sometimes teachers or sometimes family members or physicians using language that can, you know, can hurt people's feelings. And I think this sort of, this type of thing is also weighs on providers who really want to use the right language, but aren't seeing people with obesity as their primary role. So they're not, you know, for you and I, we're this is what we do. And so we get a lot of practice with our language and, you know, get to try things, different ways of saying things and get to see which works best. I think ultimately talking about sort of things like genetic risk and hereditary nature of some of this does also remove some of the bias and stigma. You know, we do some genetic testing, and I think I've noticed that sometimes families feel relieved that it might be one of the first places they've been seen where they don't feel like carrying extra weight is their fault. That being said, I think the majority of the primary care providers that refer to me are using very good language. It's just those sort of outliers that I think where people feel offended. It's certainly not the vast majority of patients I see that have had the experience in their medical offices, fortunately.
No, absolutely. And I think a lot of the people we see here, a lot of people that are seen in primary care who carry extra weight, you know, if you dig deep enough, a lot of people have had a history of trauma, abuse, neglect, kind of grew up in homes that, you know, weren't ideal, perhaps, you know, issues with poverty, issues with substance abuse in the family. And to some extent, sometimes this weight gain is a defense mechanism that kind of people have built up over years and years over time. So I think these people deserve a huge amount of empathy because they're doing the best they can and struggling. You know, oftentimes I'll see patients who said, my father was an alcoholic, my brother's an alcoholic. You know, I avoided alcohol, but I feel like this was my kind of pill to take, is that, you know, my defense mechanism was eating. So we often will see people coming from a background of lots of trauma, neglect, abuse in their family, and, you know, these people deserve a lot of empathy to help them improve their quality of life and improve their health.
Yeah, I agree. And you can see people get so engaged when we find the right tool. You know, someone who seemed like they weren't that engaged, really hard to connect with in clinic, you know, if you're, you know, and you find the right tool for them, and they somehow then become some of the patients that are the most likely to show up for their visits and the, you know, who really are the most engaged in their care, which is pretty exciting when you get to see that change.
Right. Right. Yeah. And one of the things is, you know, we've had an electronic medical record here at Maine Health now for 15 years, I think. And one of the nice things I do all the time is to kind of go back with them if they are willing to kind of look at their history, and you can use the graph function to look at their weight over time. And it's sometimes very helpful to say, hey, you lost a bunch of weight in 2016. What was going on back there? Or you gained a bunch of weight in 2018. What was going on? And people often have a narrative or a story, and you know, they were on a new medicine. They were going through a divorce. They, you know, started an exercise program with a friend from work. So it's often not random when people kind of gain or lose a bunch of weight, and having that story for people to share can be quite helpful for them to reflect and say, oh yeah, you know, I was exercising back in 2019 with a friend, and, you know, I was feeling better. My blood pressure was better. I was sleeping better. My mood was better, you know, and I lost some weight. So having people reflect on what they've been through in the past, because this is typically not a new thing for them. This is something they've struggled with sometimes for decades, can be quite helpful for them.
I do think one of the other challenges that, or maybe misconceptions that are out there is if we try to do this work, that we may end up creating a less healthy relationship for the patients with food and their bodies. And, you know, in pediatrics, the best information I think we have, you know, to avoid doing something like creating an eating disorder is to try not to focus much on weight, even though we're checking weight when people come into clinic. And I think looking at BMI as a marker of saying, hey, this is a health risk, I think those things are really important. But, you know, focusing on the changes people are able to make when they're coming into clinic, not just the changes on their BMI. In fact, maybe being really careful to get, you know, too excited with the patient when they come in and their BMI has shifted, and keep that inquisitive mind. Like you said, when you were journaling, you mentioned, you know, looking at it as, hey, what went well? What was a challenge when things weren't going well, and just acknowledging it and using it as information, as opposed to, creating too much of a celebration when things move in the right direction, because then people may feel the opposite when they come in and life was more difficult.
Absolutely. So case in point, we talk about all the time is exercise. So we know exercise is good for all of us, and we're supposed to exercise 30 minutes or more of moderate activity, you know, most days a week, and do some strength training twice a week. And people often will kind of change their exercise, but studies, when they do big studies across the country, don't usually show that a lot of exercise increases the amount of weight they lose. So patients come in and they said, gosh, I've been going to the gym, or I've been going for a walk, you know, most of the days, and I'm frustrated because I've only lost, you know, 2 pounds or 3 pounds, or their weight is about the same. But when you dive down, they actually report they feel better. They might be sleeping better. Their mood might be better. You know, their clothes might fit better. They have more energy. So there are other non-scale victories that patients will have and realize that it's not just the number on the scale, but also they feel better. There are other things that are improved when they're exercising more, when they're moving more, you know, when they're less sedentary. So I totally agree that sometimes we focus too much on that number on the scale. And there are other things that are markers for improved health that aren't just that number that, you know, people look down and see when they stand on the scale.
Yeah. I mean, you know, building our muscle tissue and maybe decreasing our adipose tissue, that's going to help with inflammation, right? So all those things you mentioned and other things like insulin resistance and help with fatty liver and so many of the other comorbidities that we're seeing. So exercise is a perfect example of that.
Yeah. And the trick with exercise is to do something that's convenient, right? So if you have to drive a half hour to get to a gym, and you go at 5 o'clock at night after work and it's very crowded, it's going to be really hard to kind of be consistent. So the best exercise is, you know, something you like to do, something that's convenient to do, often at home. You know, if you're able to kind of go outside and take a walk, or if you have any equipment at home, that's probably the same thing that people are going to be most successful with. Obviously, it's difficult in Maine to go outside in January to exercise, but we know almost everybody has a smartphone or internet access, so you can look at YouTube videos and, you know, chair exercises, chair yoga, just kind of basic exercises to try to be more active. And the other thing I often tell people about, and they might know already, is a lot of the watches they wear, you know, count their steps. Their phone will count their steps. That will count the number of flights they do. So they can do something over time. And if they're using a device, they can get feedback from that device to say, oh, I did 3,000 steps a day. You know, tomorrow, maybe I'll try to do another 5 minutes and see what I can do to improve that. So over time, people feel more comfortable and confident, you know, and more successful, because once they're doing things for, you know, 3 months or so, it's more likely to become habit. But just starting off slow and not trying to do too much to begin with is where people are going to find some success.
Well, I think, you know, the real purpose today for me of wanting to do this sort of topic for the podcast was, I feel like there's still probably some misinformation out there about how effective the treatments are for obesity. And I think this is a great discussion about all the different things we can do using some of the new tools, but also making sure we don't forget sort of some of the, some of the other lifestyle stuff that we're talking about today, the nutrition and activity. I think these things all work together in a really powerful way. And once you kind of get feel down for it and your comfort with it, it can be super satisfying to help people with obesity.
Absolutely. And obviously one of the best treatments we have for certain patients is surgery. We didn't even talk about surgery today, but we know that people can lose, 30 to 35% of their weight, 6 to 12 months out from surgery. And it's not an easy way out. So surgery still requires a lot of commitment and a lot of visits and a lot of behavior change. But in the appropriate patient, surgery can be life altering, and can be shown to decrease or eliminate, cure, if you'd like to use that term, diabetes or sleep apnea, things like that. So, thinking about surgery for certain patients is completely appropriate and is the best long-term treatment for patients that we see over time. So that using that form of treatment in the setting of everything else we're doing to help improve lifestyle, can provide pretty dramatic results to many of our patients that are appropriate for this procedure.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. And I think that's going to have to be another topic for one of our next podcasts, because that deserves its own half an hour. And it also is one of those tools that dovetails nicely with the other tools. There are patients who've had surgery who may have some small amounts of weight regain that can totally be leveled out with initiating some of the medical therapies. So I think these things are all important and we need them all.
No, absolutely. And just having, providers knowing what the potential treatments for this disease process are is so important. And obviously, having patients be more comfortable, saying, okay, come here. This is I'm acknowledging this is a problem. What are the small steps I can take to be healthier? Obviously lifestyle's huge, stress management, sleep, medications, surgery, some people can use meal replacements, things like that. So all of these things I often talk in terms of a puzzle. Are pieces of the puzzle, and that everyone has a different story. Everyone has a different treatment protocol, but everyone can benefit from most of these aspects of treatment to help their weight and help improve their life.
What a great way to sum things up. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today, Pete, and for the work that you're doing.
Thank you, Carrie. Have a great day.
You too.
Thanks for listening to Let's Talk About Obesity Care. You can find all of our episodes on your podcast app and on our webpage, letsgo.org. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, we'd really love to hear from you. Please email us at info@letsgo.org. Let's Talk About Obesity Care is produced by Let's Go, with technical support from Maine Health Educational Services. Thanks so much for joining us.